We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name is Margaret, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 27, 1991. And on April 27, 1991, I had an experience that changed my perspective on living forever. On that day, I had some beer. And when I had that beer, I felt like I had crawled into the bottle, pulled the cork in on myself, and the glass of the beer bottle was between me and the rest of the world, and that I was completely isolated from everyone, even though I was in a room full of people that knew me, that loved me, that wanted to be with me, or so it seemed, but I could not be with them. I was surrendered completely to the alcohol. The alcohol takes over my thinking, takes over my actions, and I can't do anything of my own accord until that alcohol passes out of my system, and I had never been aware of that until that time. Until that moment, I had plenty of problems with alcohol, and I knew about it, but I thought all my problems were with alcohol were due to all the people around me who were drinking alcohol, not myself. So alcohol, I thought, was a solution. And it was. Alcohol helped me get through whatever moment that I felt was uncomfortable just fine until that moment. And that day, I had gone a period of time without having a drink for about 2 years, mostly because of pregnancy and nursing. I had been informed that it could cause harm to my child, and I decided I was not going to cause harm to that child, and I was going to refrain. I was a white-knuckled, dry drunk for 2 years until that moment. And when I drank in that moment, I understood what alcohol did to me. And that was a Friday night. I'm not sure. But it was a time with my sister, and I got to leave that house, and I had my two children with me, and I took them home, and I was very clear that I couldn't drink anymore after that night. I didn't know how I was not going to drink, but I had decided I would not drink, and I had a pretty good idea that I needed to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Until that time, I came into AA through the back door of Al-Anon. And so I had regular Al-Anon meetings that I went to, and I was pretty convinced that I needed to get to the AA meeting, but I really didn't know when and where I was going to do that. So I went to the Al-Anon meetings. And a couple days after I had this realization, I had my daughter and I had an argument as we were getting ready under pressure, as always, to leave for school. And I dropped them off and then I would go to work. And I was really under the gun because I'd been informed by my workplace if I was late anymore, I was going to be let go. And that was our rent. That was our bread and butter. If I got let go from that job, what was I going to do? I had no idea. I was terrified. And my kids, I thought they were making me late. And so we had an argument, and we had the argument all the way to school. And she got out of the car, slammed the door, walked into traffic, and walked right into an oncoming vehicle and got knocked over. I thought she'd just wake up. Kept telling everybody, she's going to wake up. but she didn't. Paramedics suggested that she go to the hospital. They took her to the hospital. I went home. This is before cell phones. Somehow they got my phone number. They called me. The phone was ringing when I walked in the door. Someone had taken my little boy, my son, to the daycare. And it told me to go to the hospital, but I couldn't go to the hospital. I went home. I opened the door and the phone was ringing. I picked up the phone. They said, if you'll give us permission, we'll operate right now. They said, your daughter's losing a lot of blood. We don't know why. We need to operate. I gave the permission and I made it to the hospital. That child lost 4 pints of blood, had a ruptured spleen. They operated. They saved the spleen. She had head trauma. It recovered. And that was an ongoing process for some time. In the meantime, I sat in that operating room, not in the operating room, the recovery, the waiting room, and called people. I called people in Al-Anon. I called people, came from work. People were there, much to my, I had no idea people would come, but people came. And I kept thinking, I just can't drink. I just can't drink. And I went to an Al-Anon meeting. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And I had to go back to the hospital and be with my daughter. I got to go home at night and be with my son. I got to just keep doing these things. And I kept thinking, don't drink, don't drink, don't drink. And finally, one day, a couple weeks later, I was able to make it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked into the meeting and I sat down and they asked for newcomers. And I said, I'm Margaret. I'm an alcoholic. And I felt like I'd come home. I felt like I fit in my skin. I felt like for once I was okay, because I hadn't been okay for a long time. And that moment I wanted to keep. That moment was a moment that I felt connected to the people in the room. And they said, keep coming back. And I went back. I went back the next week, and I went back the next week. And my daughter healed, and my son was okay. And I kept going to these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that there were other meetings. I picked up my kids from school. I got them Happy Meals. We went to the 5:30 meeting, and we sat in there, and They had their hamburger and fries, and I soaked up the meeting. At my first meeting that I went to after the meeting, somebody came up to me, an older gentleman. He came up to me and he said, if you want to get better, there's one thing you can do that's going to get you better. He said, share. Share. And so every time I was called on, I shared. I shared what was going on. I tried to follow the direction, your experience, strength, and hope. I was told share in a general way. What happened? What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I ended every share. Thank you for letting me share. And I'd go to these meetings and people would say, you can't bring your kids. I didn't have any place to leave my kids. Other people said, keep coming and bring your kids. Don't not come to the meetings. I understood I couldn't drink alcohol anymore. I didn't understand anything else. Gradually, I started to understand that my life was unmanageable. But I just kept coming back because that was the only way life was becoming manageable. An older woman came up to me after one of the meetings and she said, you have a different plateful than some people that come in these rooms. You still have a job. You still have your kids. And so you probably will not be able to do all the things people are going to tell you to do. you don't listen to them. You just keep coming back as much as you can and when you can. If they say you go to 90 meetings in 90 days and you can't do it, don't listen to that. Just keep coming when you can. Somehow I made it to 90 meetings in 90 days because I couldn't figure out how to go home and not drink. I couldn't figure out how to go home and just be in my skin with these kids. And somehow I managed to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And at the end of 90 days, I had an idea. I had this idea that I could go home and I could fix dinner and I could help my children with their homework. And I did that and it worked. I kept going back to the meetings. I started to just go. I was told, find 3 meetings that you can go to on a regular basis. And I got a sponsor. And I called her. And I went to the same meeting as her. We went on Monday nights. It was a step study. I figured out that if I needed to get the most bang for my buck, so to speak, from the meetings. And so I looked through the schedules. I could only take my kids to the open meetings. I understood that. And so I went to open meetings. After a while, I found out I could go to, I was able to get a childcare arrangement. And I was able to add a closed women's step study. And one night a week, I went to a meeting by myself. And then I would take my kids with me to the other meetings. And I would call. I called people. I just did those basic things. I understood, keep coming back. I began to understand, do the next indicated thing. Halt. I learned halt, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And I understood that I was powerless over alcohol. I did not understand what the rest of the steps meant. It was as if they were Greek. So I lived on the slogans. Do the next indicated thing. Keep coming back. First things first. I could figure out those things and not pick up a drink. And I kept coming back. And I listened in the meetings and I shared. I shared whenever I was called on. And so I got through the first year and I took a chip. And at that meeting where I took my first year chip, one of the people came up to me and she said, I didn't think you'd make it. And I was curious. And I was just kind of stunned. I didn't say anything back, but she said, I didn't think you'd make it, but I'm glad you did. And I know now that I was trying to manage life. And I was. That was the only tool I had, was how do you, you know, manage, take care of the kids, go to work, pay the bills, put the food on the table. And I was hanging on to that with all that I could. And it was hard for me to socialize. My sponsor had me going to a meeting that had a break. And I really did not like it. I did not like having a break. I didn't like this idea that I had an unassigned time. But I did it. I went to the meeting anyway. And I learned to talk to people during the break. And I kept going back. After a while, my other child had an illness that put him in the hospital around my 1 year anniversary. And he was in the hospital for a month because they didn't know what was wrong with him. And he was eventually diagnosed with a rare disease. It was not cancer, but it acted like cancer. And so he had to have chemo. And people from the meetings, helped me. Helped me suit up and show up. Helped me be there for that child. When I was going to the, in the hospital with him, Every day they did more tests. They did more tests. He wasn't even 2 years old. And or he had just turned two. Yeah. And he was getting these tests, and they were painful and they hurt, and it was so hard to watch him go through these things. And I just kept saying, we have to do this. And the doctors informed me that I was part of their team, that my experience with my children was important to them, that I was their eyes and ears, and that I knew my child better than they did. And this was news. This was different, and it was only because of, you know, I had learned through going to the meetings for a year that I had to pay attention. And by going to the meetings, I also learned to trust my, you know, I learned that I could trust what I was feeling, and that it was important to feel the feelings. You know, they say when you come in the program, they say you feel everything. That's what we get to do, is we get to feel everything. The good news is you get to feel good. The bad news is you get to feel everything. The bad news is you get to feel everything. And I was so full of fear. And that was my primary feeling, was just being afraid. And the acronyms came to, you know, I learned fear is fuck everything and run. I learned fear is false expectations appearing real. And I kept being reminded that everything that I was feeling oftentimes was based on false expectations. And how was I going to help doctors if I was in fear all the time? But it was my gut that got us to the hospital to begin with. Unlike when my daughter had the accident the year before, when I would just say, oh, she's going to wake up, she's going to wake up, she's going to wake up, with my son, when he stopped, when he was in pain, when he wasn't moving, when things just didn't seem right, I knew something was wrong, and I was able to stop pretending that things were okay. I was able to pick up that child and go to the doctors and say, help, what's wrong with him? And the day came when he had stopped walking. He just sat there, and I dropped him off at the daycare, and I'd gone to work, and the phone call came at work, and they said he hasn't moved. And I said, that's it. And I told my boss I had to go. My child was very sick. And I picked up my child and I walked into the doctor's office and I told them, I'm not going home till I know what's wrong. And they sent us to the emergency room at the hospital, and they did scans on him, and they admitted him to the children's pediatric oncology ward because he presented like he had cancer, like tumors, and they were like tumors all over his body. And they said, this is, you know, we need to run these tests. And so in the process of running all these tests, they said, you are eyes and ears to this child. And I said, okay. And I said, let's find out what's wrong with him. And I kept saying to my son, okay, this is going to help us find out. This is going to help us find out. And I'd hold his hand and they'd do these tests. And finally, one day I had it and I walked in and I just lost it. I called them, the team. I was like, when is this going to end? And I just lost it. And they looked at me and they said, we've been waiting for you to fall apart. We've been waiting for you to do this. We have never seen anybody hold it together as much as you have. And I was shocked. And that was one more thing. It's like, feel the feelings. I was feeling all the feelings I'd been trying to hold in. I felt feelings and I didn't die. I didn't fall apart. I was just a person feeling the feelings. And somehow in all of that, I learned that there is a higher power. I mean, I did believe in God. I had understanding that there was a creator of the universe, but that there's a higher power that I could trust my feelings to. That was a different story. I did not have that understanding. So when they said the good news is you're going to feel your feelings, and the bad news is you're going to feel your feelings, the feelings were horrible. And my reaction to feeling the feelings created a lot of damage. And so I became convinced before I got sober was that my best bet in life was to not feel. And so that's where drinking came in. That's where, you know, I discovered sometime into sobriety, and this was quite a few years down the road in sobriety. I knew that I came from a family where drinking was in integrated. It was part of the fabric of our lives. It was everything. I'm Irish. Beer and wine and whiskey, good whiskey. That was part of the fabric of our lives. And that was the community that I grew up in. And that was the family I grew up in. And if, you know, having a little sherry with dinner on Sunday night, and sometimes us children were included in that, just a few sips in the glass, and getting to take sips out of my dad's beer as a little kid. And when I was in my middle childhood, still on the young side, I was the oldest of five kids, and we were all stair-stepped. We were 1 year apart. And I was the oldest. And so I was my mom's help. And we all helped my mom. We all did, you know, what my mom told us to do. But I was the lead person on that. And so everybody was sick. And my mom gave me directions to make hot toddies. And she instructed me to put a small amount of whiskey into each one of the kids. And I took a sip of it. And I was like, whoa, this stuff's pretty good. And so I went ahead and I measured out, as directed, the lemon, the honey, the hot water, and a little bit of whiskey. Except when it came to mine, I gave myself a whole shot of whiskey. And then on top of it, I drank a whole shot of whiskey. And then I delivered the toddies to everybody, and I thought that was okay. And periodically, I would just go, I discovered whiskey. And I periodically would just go and open the bottle and have some whiskey. I don't know how much I had, just had a couple gulps, put the lid back on and put the cork back in and put it back in the cupboard. And I didn't do it all the time, but I definitely decided that that was a pretty good thing to do. I just loved the whiskey going down my throat. I loved how it felt going into my gut. I love that sense of, I guess it was a relief or something, but that was my solution. I didn't know it was a solution. It's just something I did. I just did it. And I didn't do it all the time. I just did it periodically. But it was there, and I did it. And that continued along, and gradually as I got into my teens, I'd have a beer here and there with the cousins, and at our family gatherings, there was a wash tub that was filled with beer. And all of the cousins, they'd get it, you know, stand around. And it was such wonderful camaraderie. It was a great family. Such wonderful camaraderie. And I couldn't wait to be old enough to stand there and join them in the beer and play the softball game. And be one of the adults. That's what I thought adulting was that I'd grow up and I'd get to stand there at the wash tub and have the beer with all my cousins. And we had these big family gatherings, and we did this annually, and at other times during the year. And so when I was 16, I got to go out with one of my cousins on a boat, and I got to have Mickey's malt liquor. And that was my, and I had a lot. I was really drunk. It was the best drunk ever. Mickey's malt liquor was my first drunk. And I felt so wonderful. And I never was able to achieve that again. I think the rest of my drinking probably was spent trying to achieve that. Never could quite get there, but, you know, I'd get as close as I could get. And sometimes I'd go past the mark. But anyway, back to the moment. You know, at the moment, I was the eyes and ears of my child. And I got to tell the doctors my gut feeling, and that gut feeling got us to the hospital and got us through the time of the diagnosis. And he had a rare disease. It wasn't cancer, but it needed chemotherapy. And so he maneuvered through all of that. And I kept going to the meetings, and I kept calling a sponsor, and I kept living on the slogans because it was a survival mode. It was the roof over the head, the meals on the table, and it was remembering to be thankful. Gratitude. Be grateful. I was grateful to have the roof over the head. I was grateful we could have the meals on the table. And I was grateful for the laughs we had under that roof. I was grateful to be able to be the parent, to be the sober parent of these kids, even though I didn't understand what that was all about. I knew not drinking and being able to laugh with them was the biggest gift of my world. And being able to share that with people when I went to the meetings was the best gift in the world. And that eventually I got to learn that my kids needed to do things like they needed to be in sports, and they needed to be able to participate in the school events. And I got to do that with them. And I gradually understood that there was a power greater than myself. And that was how I got to do this program, was through a power greater than myself, I got restored to sanity. Because doing the same old thing over and over and expecting different results was not my solution. And gradually, I was also told when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that it was okay, that it was probably in my best interest just to work one program for the year. And I was informed by my Al-Anon sponsor that my main program needed to be AA. And she said, you're going to come back to Al-Anon, but you're going to need to work this program because this is who you are. And that's what I did. This knowledge that I was an alcoholic was something that I was stair-stepped into. Even though I had the startling realization that night when I climbed in the bottle and pulled the cork in on myself, I'd been stair-stepped into that point through Al-Anon. I kept going to those meetings, and I'd call people, and I didn't understand what it was all about, but I knew I felt better going to the meetings. I knew I felt better when I called people. And I'd call people, and they'd say, honey, we've helped you as much as you can. I can't help you anymore. But here's another number. Call this woman. She'll be able to help you. And I called that woman, and I called her, and I called her, and eventually she said, I can't help you anymore, but here's somebody who can, and let me give you this phone number. And this happened 3 or 4 times in the rooms of Al-Anon. And finally, I got connected with this woman. Everybody called her a black belt Al-Anon. And she said, I'll help you. And the day came when she said to me, she said, you're doing everything I'm telling you to do, and you're not getting better. This program is not working for you. You need to go to therapy. And I said, I'm not going to therapy. Not ever going to therapy again. And she said to me, she said, I think you need to try this therapist. She follows the 12-step program. I think you can give her a try. And only because she said that therapist followed a 12-step program, I went to that therapist. And I kept going back to her. And I was going to that therapist for a year. And at the end of that year, I walked into her and I said, and that's where I had the experience that I'd crawled into the bottle and I told my therapist I'm an alcoholic. And she said, I knew that. I said, how long have you known that? And she said, oh, I've known that since the day you walked in here. And I said, why didn't you tell me? And she said, because it's something you had to come to your own understanding of. You had to know inside yourself that you were an alcoholic. Well, I sure knew that. So it's an inside job. It's an inside job that I had to become an alcoholic. I had to admit to my innermost self. I had to admit that it was the alcohol that was my problem. And I knew that beyond doubt. And that incomprehensible demoralization began to fade with going to the meetings. Life may not have made sense, but it became something I could do. I could function in it. And gradually I began to understand. And one day I was, okay, I'm gonna try these steps. And I went to my sponsor at the time and I said, I want to do the steps. And so we went through the steps. And we did the third step, and then she got me to the fourth step, and she had me do, I was 4 years sober at this time before I did my first four step. And she had me write down the columns, and she said, go down the columns, make a list. And then beside each person, place or thing in that list, put the cause. And then do the third column, how it affects me. And she said, when you get that done, we're going to meet. And she helped me figure out my part in it. And at the end of that, we had a meeting. And in the fifth, chapter five, at the end, at the very end of chapter five, there's a sentence, two sentences. It says, if you've gotten this far, I'm paraphrasing right now because I don't have it right in front of me. But it says, you've gotten this far. You've uncovered some big chunks of truth about yourself. And you've uncovered some of your grosser handicaps. And I could accept that. And then my sponsor added, she said, and the rest of it will be, more will be revealed. The rest of it is fine-tuned. And you can trust that more will be revealed. And just like the onion example that so many of us have heard, peeling back the layers of the onion. Yes, more has been revealed. Because at that point in time, I still didn't realize, didn't understand that I had started drinking. I thought my drinking career started when I was 16. I didn't realize it was revealed later that my drinking actually started when I was a child. That I had alcoholic thinking from the get-go. And that alcohol was my solution early on. And it wasn't until I was going to the meetings, you know, I'm here. It was very interesting to me that, not interesting, but it's thinking back on it, you can say it's interesting. When I went to the meeting, these people really took me in and they did things to keep me coming back. And one of the things they did was they said, you need a commitment. You need to be of service. And they gave me a literature commitment. And the literature commitment at that meeting was you had to take all the books with you and you had to pack them up in a box and you had to put them in your trunk and you had to bring them back every week. And so I did this for several weeks, for a while, for several, maybe a few months. And I woke up once, this was a Saturday meeting, and I woke up one Saturday morning and I said, wow, I didn't have a drink for 2 years. I'm not an alcoholic. That was just a little incident, you know, where I had that happen. I'm not an alcoholic. I don't need these meetings. I was able to not drink for 2 whole years. And I decided I was going to take those books back to that meeting because I didn't need them. They needed them. I'd take those books back to those people at that meeting and I would tell them I don't need this anymore, that I'm going to be okay. And I had a tendency to run late. That's one of my character defects. And I walked in a few minutes late to the meeting, and they were doing the opening introduction of a leader. And I was like, okay, I can't tell them right now. I'll just set these books up and I'll sit down and I'll tell them at the break. So I sat down just as the leader was starting his introduction. And he said, I was talking to somebody this morning who didn't think they were an alcoholic because they hadn't had a drink in 2 years. Those were the words that were exactly in my head. And I felt like the Red Sea had parted in front of me. I was stunned. I was like, okay, God, I guess I need to be here. I guess I need to hear what this person has to say. And I stayed for the meeting and I didn't leave the program. I kept that literature commitment. I kept going back. But once again, you know, I decided that maybe I wasn't an alcoholic. Sometime later, I had decided I was going to try going to speaker meetings, and I got childcare and I went to the speaker meeting and I walked into this one meeting and this lady shared and she was telling her story, and it was blackout drinking after blackout drinking after blackout drinking. And I left that meeting thinking, I'm not an alcoholic. I didn't have blackouts. I don't have to go back to these meetings. And I drove home thinking, I'm done. I'm fixed. I don't have to go back to those meetings. And as I was unlocking the front door to my house and walking in it, I was suddenly struck by a blackout memory. I had remembered that I had a blackout. And I was in college at the time, and I hadn't remembered. I remembered going to the class. It was a Shakespeare class. I remembered sitting in the class. I don't remember how I got to the class. I don't remember getting to the class, but I remember sitting in that class, and I remember watching my hand try to write. Because it was like writing with spaghetti. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And the next thing I remember, I was several blocks away from that class. And I was trying to figure out how to cross the street because I could barely get down off of the curb into the street. And then the next thing I remembered was sometime later, I was at work. I don't know how I got to work, but I was at work. And then the next thing I remembered after that, I was at home. And I have no idea what transpired for that entire day, except for those two moments. And I remember saying to my sister at some point, it's the funniest thing, I just can't remember what I did. And this happened several times, of course, but this particular moment of being in a blackout and coming and going back into it struck me as I walked into the door, and all of a sudden I realized I was just like that woman who had shared blackout after blackout. I was a blackout drinker. I never thought of myself as a blackout drinker until that moment, but yeah, I was a blackout drinker. And I had times in my life where I had no idea where I had been, what I had done, who I had been with as a result of my drinking. So I was like, All right, God, I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to keep going to these meetings. And today I don't have to pick up a drink. And these things kept happening throughout my entire sobriety, was that I would have this brilliant idea that I wasn't an alcoholic. And, you know, they talk about we'd have moments of inspiration. The God idea was with us, but we'd have these moments of inspiration, but then we had to check it, you know. And gradually, I began to trust that. I began to trust my higher power. I began to be willing to trust the higher power, and my life got better. I got to a point where I was not so much the roof over the head and the meals on the table. That became an automatic thing. It wasn't such an effort to be able to meet the rent. It wasn't such an effort to be able to buy the groceries. It was a joy. I was able to do things with my children. I could go on a trip. I could take a vacation with them. And gradually these kids, they grew. We needed to move out of the one bedroom apartment that we were in. I had a boy and a girl. They needed their own bedrooms. I was like, okay, God, I guess we got to move. And one thing led to another, and it was a good idea to buy a house. I actually was able, I was at a time in this economy when buying a house was cheaper than the rent. And I was able to get into a house. I said, okay, I'm willing to move. Okay, I'm willing to consider this idea that somebody suggested that I buy a house. I went with a realtor. We looked at a bunch of places. She guided me to make an offer. I made the offer. 60 days later, we had a house. We had a house. I was a homeowner. I didn't know what the heck I was doing, except this was a place for me and my kids. And I got to be sober. I got to have people over. I got to have sober parties. I got to celebrate my kids' birthdays. I no longer had to put wine and beer at the top of my shopping list to celebrate their birthdays. I got to do these things sober and really celebrate my kids. And this was the gift of sobriety. And my thinking took over again. I met somebody in sobriety. It was love at first sight. And we got married. We were open to the idea. We both had children already. We were open to the idea that we could, if we got one more child, and that was all it took, the powers of the universe, it seemed, blessed us with a kid. That kid is now 21. But along the way, you know, I got to have my own thinking take over again. And my own thinking was, I have to have things a certain way. I have to have my kids happy. I have to have all these things. And the tool that I used was the house. The money that should have been going into the house to build the equity, I started spending to keep my family happy. Because I didn't trust that we were okay the way we were. And so I spent the money of the house. And I wound up owing so much on the house that when the economy tanked, we were so upside down that I could either pay the house payment or we could eat the groceries. And I forgot how to breathe. I couldn't breathe. I was felt paralyzed. I got led to another 12-step program, and that program taught me how to surrender the idea that money could fix everything and how to stay sober and do that at the same time. And I got to let go of the house. And what happened in letting go of the house was that I had to one more time turn everything over to my higher power. I had to. It was the scariest thing. I thought I was falling into a bottomless pit. And I said, okay, I'm going to let go of the house. And I told somebody I was going to let go of the house. And they said, okay, now you need to find another place to live. And they directed me to look on Craigslist. And I made two calls. And I connected with somebody. I explained to her that my finances were completely upside down. And I said to her, but I have the same job. I haven't lost my job. I have an income. And I had enough income to meet that rent requirement. And she took me in. She rented me the house. This happened within 20 minutes. 20 minutes of deciding to let that house go. I had another house. My higher power took care of me because I trusted. I became willing to be willing. And my higher power did not let me down. I just didn't pick up a drink. I did all kinds of alcoholic thinking. And I was dry. Such a dry drunk. But in that moment when I became willing to be willing again, I picked up the tools. I took the contrary action. I started the steps over. I had a new sponsor, and I did the next indicated thing. And I went through the steps again, and I got another place to live. It was better than the other place. I was paying rent. But the bottom line was, is we had a place. I had a place that was safe and gracious and comfortable. And we were able to be there. And I got to learn to change and to realize that I didn't have to try to fix everything. And that has been the biggest blessing in my life. Today, I don't have to try to fix everything. I just suit up and show up. I just get to be of service. I just, you know, and through this process, I also got to go back to school and I got another degree, and I was able to still keep my job and do one of the things I'd always dreamt of doing, which I teach college English now. And the way to get that job was just the same thing happened again. My youngest child graduated from high school and he left. He went to Germany for a year, and I was like, okay, now I can think about teaching. And I said, all right, I'm gonna get ready to do that next year. I'm gonna take this year to get ready to do that. And I was walking out from work one day and I saw my mentor from my grad program, and I work at the university, and I saw my mentor from the grad program I had been in at the parking lot, and I said, hi, how are you? And she said, terrible. And I said, what's going on? And she said, can you teach a class for me? And I said, sure. And she said, good. One of the instructors, one of the faculty had fallen and had an injury and could not continue teaching the class. And it turned out to be, it was my graduate advisor. And so when she said, I need somebody to teach this class, not only was I teaching a class, but I was teaching things I actually knew. I actually knew how to teach these things because that was my grad program that I was teaching. And I walked into that room and I just met these students. I was like, I haven't done this before, but I know this stuff. And I was just one step ahead of them. Just like when I learned to sponsor people, I'm one step ahead of them. I did it with them. And that's how I get to do life today. I just get to do it one step at a time and get ready one step at a time. And sometimes I actually get to plan a little in advance, and I've learned how to plan and not live in the future. Just make the idea, put it down and turn it over. Turn it over sounds like such a weird phrase, but turning it over just means that I get to have an idea and I get to do the next indicated thing. And if that thing is going to come true, I will get there. I don't have to live it. I don't have to be fearful. Fear, I've learned, is also future events already ruined. So I just try to stay in the now and do the next indicated thing. And that is my sobriety, is doing the next indicated thing. And I don't do it perfectly. Right now I'm walking through a bunch of stuff where I'm full of fear. And I'm not perfect. I blow it. But I have a place to go. I get to go to these meetings and I get to listen to people and I get to be of service and I get to share my experience, my strength, and my hope. And I thank all of you for listening to this message, to this share, because one more time, I'm remembering it's a gift. Sobriety, not having to pick up a drink. And every time I'm willing to be willing not to pick up a drink, I have a higher power that comes in and just turns my life around. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. 31 years of sobriety. That is definitely old-timer age of sobriety. And you celebrated it not too long ago, so happy birthday. A few questions. You talked a lot about feelings, feeling wonderful when you had your Mickey's malt liquor. And then you talked about your children and the way you reacted the first time when your daughter got hit. And then the way a year later in sobriety, you went over your presence and your reaction and your ability to be there for your son. Then you mentioned fear at the very end there. So when you go in fear today, do you go back to those basic things you talked about? First things first, next indicated thing, halt. Or have you developed some more sophisticated ways of handling fear than you did early on?
I go back to the basics. I call the program my ABC blocks to living life. I have to keep it simple. I will complicate everything in a heartbeat. So it's like, okay, what's the first thing first? Yes, I go back how I got to the program, how I entered the program, those first experiences in the program. I've learned that that's my foundation to living life on life's terms. Those coming into the program, accepting that I was powerless over alcohol, the tangible experience of knowing, of understanding that when alcohol entered my body, I had a drink in my hand, that alcohol hit my throat, and life was good. That I knew that was a solution to whatever was my problem was at that moment, good, bad, or indifferent. And it didn't even have to be a problem, but that was a solution that made life better. And if things were good, that made it even better. So that was the key of alcohol, was that I knew I could trust alcohol until it couldn't. And I couldn't trust alcohol the day I realized that when I take alcohol into my body, I can't control my thinking. I surrender what I'm thinking. I surrender my body's actions to the alcohol acting in my body. That tangible connection is the connection that I carry with me today. Because that's when life started to make sense.
You had mentioned AA and Al-Anon and perhaps another 12-step program that you didn't call out by name. I'm not sure if I heard that correctly. And when you went into the rooms of AA for the first time, I think, you said you felt like you had come home.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference for you between Al-Anon and AA, and what makes one feel like home?
AA gave me the ABC blocks. Al-Anon was a safe place. It was a safe place from the chaos I could create. But I'd never learned how to leave there and live differently. Not until after I had gotten sober. I can go to an Al-Anon meeting and I can get stuff today and I can use that stuff. But it wasn't until after I had gotten sober, until after I had put down the alcohol, that I got tools to live life on life's terms.
Do you live on life on life's terms today, or do you find that you still have to have things a certain way and have to try to fix everything? Has there been progress over the last 31 years? Have you solved that character defect, or does it still pop up?
Character defects are not something that ever completely go away, in my opinion. And the reason I was given this image about character defects is that they exist on a spectrum. They have opposite ends as if they're on a pendulum. And so when I'm in my character defects, I'm at the far end of a pendulum swing. And my job is to get to the middle. If I go too far to the other side, I mean, that's great. It's a wonderful feeling. But my job is just to get me to the middle.
I really appreciate that visual. So, final question, Margaret. I really appreciate your time and going through these questions. I absolutely loved the way that you did your 90 and 90 and you brought your kids with you and you brought them dinner. And what a great example for any newcomer mom or dad, single parent coming in. And then you said, I couldn't figure out how to go home and not drink. So I just went to a meeting every day for 90 days. And then after that, you were able to come up with this great idea. I'll just fix dinner and help my kids with their homework. So for the newcomer that is not figuring out how to do life. Oh yeah, there was another quote that you said, something, life may not have made sense, but it was something I could do. So in the beginning, your sobriety, it didn't make sense, but you can do it. And your 90 and 90, I imagine, got you there in more than one way. So for the newcomer, what message do you want to leave for them? Perhaps it's about the 90 and 90 experience. Perhaps it's something completely else. I'll let you take it.
Oh, my goodness. It's trite, but it's just keep coming back. Keep coming back. You know, the old hermits say, keep coming back, even if your ass falls off. It is in the rooms. I have had times in my sobriety where I didn't go to meetings for a whole bunch of various reasons. And in my earlier sobriety, if I didn't go to meetings, I wasn't doing much. But in my later sobriety, in the times when I've had when I didn't go to meetings, I would read the book. I would call people. But eventually I got to a point where I needed that connection. And, you know, what I've learned is that my higher power is in my connection with other people. And it's best in connection with other people who are also walking this journey of being willing to be sober. You know, they said, come in these rooms, you just have to have the desire not to drink. You know, maybe you don't even have the desire not to drink, but you have a desire to have things go differently. This is a place in Alcoholics Anonymous that I learned that I can do things differently. And that even if I'm not perfect, and I'm certainly not perfect, I can keep coming back. I keep coming back.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.